Okay, the Grecian Empire takes over. Alexander the Great, as several of the teachers have mentioned him, and I think we're fairly familiar with him. He set out, he was the son of Philip, who was a great king of Macedonia, and Alexander took his place. He set out to conquer the world. It took him about 12 years or so, and then he died. Alexander was tutored under Aristotle when he was 13 years old. That'd be quite an education, wouldn't it? And he was appointed regent of Greece by his father Philip when he was 16. When he was 20, he assumed command of the Greek army. It was the spring of 334 BC that he crossed the Hellespont River with 35,000 men and began the conquest of the Persian Empire. He defeated the Persians at the Granicus River in Asia Minor, and he also defeated the Persians at Issus, I-S-S-U-S, at the northeast corner of the Mediterranean Sea. And the conquered Persians numbered about 600,000. It's amazing. So the Greeks were outnumbered, but they still were able to defeat the great, mighty Persian army. Alexander, after great Persian victories, turned his attention south to Tyre on the Phoenician coast. And here's another thing you could put in the list of things that happened between the Testaments, is Alexander's conquest of Tyre. And it was a fulfillment of that prophecy that Ezekiel had made in Ezekiel 26. And that was an interesting prophecy in Ezekiel 26, because it said that the destruction of Tyre would be kind of like waves of the sea. There would be one way, and then there'd be another way, and another way. Nebuchadnezzar was sort of like the first wave, and Alexander was the one who really did them in. He's the one, everybody remember the story of how he took over Tyre? Tyre had the mainland city, and then it had the city out in the Mediterranean, which made them pretty confident that we're going to be fine. We're going to resist any attack, because even if they take the land city, they're not going to be able to come out and get us. But Alexander the Great, of course, was the one that took the ruins of the mainland city and scraped them out into the sea to make a causeway to get out to the island city. And that's exactly what the prophecy said would happen. This is something good to remember, because when you study the book Revelation, you'll have to look at prophecy to see how it's fulfilled, because God doesn't write any books after Revelation to tell you how it's fulfilled. And he didn't write any book to tell us how that prophecy in Ezekiel would be fulfilled. We just have to go to history. Well, what did the historian say? Did that prophecy ever come to pass? And then when you dig in history, you see it did, just like God said it would. They scraped it so that they could use it for a place for fishermen to clean their nets. And it was once a great city. Just imagine, just think of a small town, maybe a small town that you know about. Imagine it being scraped off. And you going, I remember what used to be here. Now look, it's all gone. Just an impressive thing. And it's impressive in that case, of course, because Tyre was a great city. It was a commercial center. And so much trade and everything was done there. And does everybody remember why Tyre was punished that way? Remember why Tyre got that punishment? There could have been something, I think that could be right, but what is specifically said is, they said, aha, when Jerusalem fell. they rejoiced when Jerusalem fell, which is quite a lesson, isn't it? You know, I'm not sure about aiding the Babylonians. They might have, but what God said was, your attitude was wrong when my people fell. Isn't that interesting how God works? You know, God had to punish his own people, and yet he punishes those who rejoice in it. That's why I've heard people paint eternity like the righteous will be rejoicing over all the people in hell. I don't see that in the Bible. I don't think that would be right. We're not rejoicing over anyone that goes to hell, and God isn't either. Even his worst enemies, he's not happy that they go to hell. And so God punishes God's enemies for rejoicing when he has to punish his people. Kind of reminds you, if your brother or sister got in trouble, did you ever help your brother or sister get in trouble and then rejoice? Herman's getting a beating. Come on, let's look. Herman's getting a beating. We're not supposed to rejoice like that, even if they deserve it. That's not our job. Eldon. Thank you very much, Eldon. Proverbs 24:17-18. Don't rejoice. I remember my mother telling me that, and at first I wasn't quite sure why that was such a bad thing. I kind of like to see people get punished when they deserve it. But let's remember the proverb, be very careful. So Alexander took over and destroyed Tyre, and then he took the land of Israel. He said when he came to Jerusalem, he was met by the high priest, who at that time I believe was Jaddua, at the head of a long procession of people dressed in white, while the priest was dressed in purple and scarlet with a mitre on his head. God had warned him in a dream the previous night to do this. Alexander approached Jaddua alone and saluted him, indicating that he had seen this very person, Jaddua, in a dream in Macedonia, thus believing that his army was under divine conduct. Alexander refused to allow his soldiers to harm the Jews and accompanied them back to Jerusalem. He went up to the temple and was shown the book of Daniel, wherein Daniel declared that one of the Greeks should destroy the empire of the Persians. He supposed that himself was the person intended. That's a quote from Josephus. So that's very interesting. If that is true, if Josephus' account is true, that Alexander was shown the book of Daniel. See, this is talking about you. Wouldn't that be something to see the Bible and say that it may have been referring to you. So Alexander allowed the Jews to continue in their laws and religion and to pay no tribute each seventh year. So they got a year off from paying taxes. When the Samaritans saw this treatment of the Jews, they claimed to be Jews also. Okay, well, they were half right. They were halfway right. So Alexander went from there to Egypt and on to the east. Alexander thought that the Greek or Hellenistic culture was the greatest the world had ever seen, and he determined to share it with all the people he conquered. And that's where the Hellenization starts, the making the world Greek, Hellenization. And that's understandable, you know. If you think your way is the best way, and you're a man like Alexander, then you'll want everybody to think your way. But these world empires are interesting because it's like man saying, we're going to do things our way. We're not going to let this country do its way and this country do it this way. We're going to unite everybody, And a part of their desire, I think, was, we'll maintain peace this way. But yet, it still doesn't maintain peace, does it? It maintains it to a certain degree, but eventually there's some enemy going to rise up and defeat you. The Roman Empire really does fit that description John was talking about yesterday, the strong empire, because in order for the Roman Empire to fall, it really had to start crumbling on the inside before the Germanic tribes could come down and eventually mix and mingle with them. But the Greek Empire is going to eventually succumb to the Roman Empire. What Alexander would do in order to spread the Hellenization of the world was he would establish model Greek cities such as Alexandria in Egypt. Alexandria was one of their great models of what, if all the world was like this, wouldn't it be wonderful? If all the world was like Alexandria. The influence of Greek culture, arts, and language was felt by the entire world. But if Alexander died, everybody has to die, and Alexander died when he was about 33 years old, just a youth. And he sure did a lot in his youth, didn't he? Amazing accomplishments from a worldly point of view. So upon Alexander's death, the empire, and this is what Daniel talks about in the 11th chapter, I believe. Daniel talks about how it's not left to his seed. It's left to others. It's left to these friends of his four generals. Apparently he grew up with them. And the four generals were Ptolemy, Seleucus, Lysimachus, and Cassander. And as John pointed out yesterday, the two that will stand out are the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. Cassander's in Macedonia, and that's pretty well where he stays. And Lysimachus becomes a non-participant, so to speak. Thrace and Bithynia are up there in what is now modern Turkey. And he just never was really a factor. It was Ptolemy and Seleucus that became the great ones. And in their fighting over the years, remember, Palestine's right in the middle. I think someone referred to that earlier this week, but it's just God's people are always right in the middle. It's still the same way today, isn't it, in the Middle East. Israel is right in the middle. And so the Ptolemies from Egypt and the Seleucids from Syria, they fight back and forth, and God's people suffer. We have a note here about Antiochus Epiphanes being the greatest problem to the Jews, and we'll talk some about him. Here's a map of the Hellenistic world after the death of Antigonus, and that was the one that they defeated, Seleucids defeated him, and I think Cassander may have been in on that as well. But look at the extent of this. You have the Hellenistic world, or you have the Seleucid Empire taking up Mesopotamia and going on up into the area that is now Russia. And at this time, you'll see the Ptolemies are in Damascus and Palestine. But then that's going to go back and forth with the Seleucids going down and going into Egypt during this 400-year period of time. But this gives you an idea of what we're talking about when we talk about the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. Ptolemy's rule was centered in Egypt with Alexandria as the capital. Now, let me go back to that map here. Alexandria, you can see that on the map here. And Seleucid's empire had its headquarters in Antioch. Is that interesting that his headquarters were at Antioch in Syria? What other important thing happened in Antioch in Syria? Disciples are first called Christians at Antioch, Acts chapter 11. Pretty good how the Lord works and how he's going to turn things around for his people. The Seleucid Empire was ruled by several rulers who were called Antiochus. Antiochus the First ruled from 280 to 261 BC. Antiochus the Second succeeded him. He ruled from 261 to 246. He was followed by two Seleucuses, the second and the third. And then Antiochus the Third, who was also called the Great, he succeeded Seleucus the Third. Seleucus the Fourth succeeded Antiochus the Great, and then Antiochus the Fourth, who was Antiochus Epiphanes, the one that is the most trouble during this time, he rules from 175 to 164 BC. And there follows after him five rulers before they eventually succumb to Roman rule. The Ptolemies, let's think about them for a moment here. Does anybody have any questions or comments at this point? We're going to 1. Okay. All right, very good. 115, okay. Ptolemy the First was the son of a Macedonian named Leges. He was surnamed Soter, or Deliverer, by the people of Rhodes for the military aid he had given them. They liked those surnames. Soter, Savior. He's the one that saved us. Antiochus Epiphanes, Epiphanes meaning the illustrious or the great. So they liked these surnames to show how great they were. Now, while Ptolemy's fellow generals who succeeded Alexander were fighting Antigonus in Asia Minor, he added Coele Syria, Phoenicia, Palestine, Cyrene, and Cyprus to his domain in Egypt, Libya, and Arabia. And that's what you can see on this map here. He added these areas to his domain while they were busy up here fighting Antigonus. The Jews, after the death of Alexander, had been under the rule of the Seleucids, but only for a short time. So the Seleucids started with Israel, but now Ptolemy gets it not very long after that. Ptolemy the First was not the benevolent conqueror and ruler Alexander had been. Learning that the Jews observed the Sabbath, he chose that day to take Jerusalem. That wasn't very nice, was it? Josephus quotes Agatharchides' derisive report of the conquest of Jerusalem. Josephus, quoting him, says, "The people known as Jews, who inhabit the most strongly fortified of cities, called by the natives Jerusalem, have a custom of abstaining from work every seventh day. On those occasions, they neither bear arms nor take any agricultural operations in hand, nor engage in any other forms of public service. But they pray with outstretched hands in the temples until the evening. Consequently, because the inhabitants, instead of protecting their city, persevered in their folly, Ptolemy, the son of Leges, was allowed to enter with his army. The country was thus given over to a cruel master, and the defect of a practice enjoined by law was exposed." The defect of a practice enjoined by law was exposed. "That experience has taught the whole world, except that nation, the lesson not to resort to dreams and traditional fancies about the law, until its difficulties are such as to baffle human reason." So that is definitely a very derisive report of what the Jews were doing. See how silly this religion is? You keep the Sabbath day and you leave yourselves wide open to attack. And so we took advantage of it. So Ptolemy followed the custom of other rulers in naming cities for himself. He built Ptolemais on the upper Nile, south of Abydos, to replace the old city of Thebes as his capital. He changed the name of the old city of Acco, Judges 1:31, located 30 miles south of Tyre on the Syrian coast, to Ptolemais, Acts 21:7. Acts 21:7 speaks of Ptolemais, and that's where it came from. Everybody know that already? Wouldn't be hard to figure out, would it? Let's see, Ptolemais. Ptolemy. There you go. Now, he wanted to make Alexandria a great city. That was his capital, and he wanted it to be the best. So one of the things he did was he transported 100,000 Jews into it. Isn't that interesting? I'll make my city great. I'll bring 100,000 Jews there. So he knew something about the Jews. He absorbed 3,000 Jews into his army, laying the foundation for the fulfillment of the prophecy of Isaiah in Isaiah 19:18-19. There would be an altar built in the midst of Egypt because he brought all these Jews in. So there was going to be a worship to God in Egypt. That's quite a concept. He five cities to speak the language of Canaan, one to be called the City of Destruction, evidently a reference to On, 5 miles northeast of Cairo, at that time a center for worship of the sun and called by the Greeks Heliopolis, the Sun City. That's where the Phoenix went to, wasn't it? For the Jews, built a temple there. So that's the fulfillment of the prophecy in Isaiah chapter 19 is seen in the time of Ptolemy. Ptolemy's successor was Ptolemy II, Philadelphus. And he wanted to make Alexandria a world trade center. And the practice of intermarriage with members of the royal family was a custom of the ancient pharaohs, which was adopted by the Greek rulers of Egypt. Cleopatra, the last of the Ptolemy line, was an example of the contention and infamy this practice caused. Now, Cleopatra here is the last of the Ptolemy line. Now, she had daughters and had children that would continue to rule in Egypt, but it was no longer considered the Ptolemy dynasty. Ptolemy II is known for one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. Does anybody know which ancient wonder that is? That's a good guess. He did build the Great Library. Is that one considered a seven wonder of the world? Okay, very good. So he's responsible for two then. You may know the other one. I don't think so. Remember the lighthouse? The lighthouse. Pharos. At the entrance of Alexandria's harbor. I've never seen it. Anybody seen a picture of it, or anybody seen the ruins thereof? The footings. Oh, isn't that something? Yeah. It's always good to think about the seven wonders of the ancient world because it shows they were wonderful, but they don't last. They just become ruins. I always think of the little child that was on tour with his mother, and he asked his mother, "How come the Romans always built ruins?" And that's all they are. They're just, they don't stand. But what we have in Christ you know, will be forever, and no one can take it away from us. It's surely a great treasure. So it's always good and in a way humorous to look at the seven ancient wonders of the world. But Ptolemy II was responsible for the lighthouse, and he also is the one who built the great library, and he made Alexandria a world center of learning. Does anybody remember what the church did in Alexandria? Yep, that's right. Yeah, that's true. And that takes place in this 400-year period of time. I'm thinking of after the church is started. That's good, Faber. Oh, he was from Alexandria. That's very good, yeah. I'm thinking of like the 3rd century, 2nd or 3rd century. That's right. First Christian school of learning. First Bible college was in Alexandria. And you can see how that kind of made sense, didn't it? We'll have our Bible college in Alexandria. And I think several of you read the quote from Mosheim, the church historian. He called that Bible college in Alexandria the grave of primitive Christianity, that it died there. Because the idea was, in order to compete, we have to be smart like everybody else. We have to know the Greek gods and the Greek culture and, you know, the philosophers. We got to be able to be on equal footing with them. And they didn't even realize the gospel was making great progress without any of that. The power is in the gospel. It's in the simple message of the gospel. It's not in how smart we are. It's not in how smart we are. I read about a man in the Middle East somewhere. I forgot which country it was. But he's in a Muslim country where there's lots of persecution. And this man was said to be the most effective evangelist in his community. Brought a lot of people to Christ in spite of oppression. And this American was visiting with him, and he was really anxious to meet this effective evangelist. You know, he wanted to talk to him and ask him questions. And he said the man was very shy. He didn't say much. You know, when he talked to him, he was not a chatty kind of person. And yet, he said things that help people become Christians. He knew how to help people become Christians, and he was not an educated man, and yet he was bringing people to the Lord. And the man from America said he felt ashamed of himself. But, you know, here's a man that's doing so much good, and yet he's not what anybody would pick or most people would picture as an effective worker. Well, how's he going to do any good? And yet he did. So anyway, the church is going... the gospel is all we need. It's the power of God. And we don't add anything to it by our embellishments. Andrew? Yeah. A very good point. David seemed kind of unlikely, and Jesus, of course, seemed unlikely. And fishermen for apostles. That's right. Why didn't he pick some of these guys from Alexandria? But it shows the power is in the gospel. Yeah, that's what's so great about it. So in the end, nobody can brag, yes, it's because I took this course and I took that course and I was a master salesman. No, it's the gospel that's pulling people to Christ. And we have to have our faith in the gospel. It's what saves us, and it's what will save everybody else, is the gospel. So the Ptolemies, that's what they're talking about. And here's what Faber and you're referring to. That's very, very good. The most important event of his reign, according to one historian, at least, was the translation of the Hebrew Scriptures into the Greek language, the Septuagint. The Septuagint's a pretty interesting story. And this is why, while Ptolemy has influence in that area, more influence in the area of Palestine, 12 tribes were supposed to pick six scholars, or six people who are familiar with the law. What's 12 times 6? 72. Okay. And the Septuagint is the 70. They rounded it off to 70 instead of saying 72. And those 70 were given the assignment to translate the Hebrew Scriptures into Greek. It makes sense, doesn't it? Because the languages are changing, and Hebrew is not going to be the language of choice. It's going to be reserved more for the educated Jews, the scribes. They'll still keep learning Hebrew, but the common people, they're going to be changing with the language. So this is a great blessing, and that's why you could very well say that this is the most important event of Ptolemy II's reign. He's going to make the Word of God understandable to people. He's going to put it in Greek.